Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 166, and the sound of musket fire dominates the scenery around the Eastern Cape. The Seventh Frontier War has burst into flame, and across the ceded territory and down into the land around Port Elizabeth, Amaxhosa warriors are on the warpath. The British have been forced into the defensive. If you remember last episode, Sir Peregrine Maitland declared war on the Amaxhosa chief from Golombani Sandile Ngcika on the 1st of April 1846. But the Eastern Xhosa, the Xaleka under Sarhili, had remained out of the war, at least for now. The Xhosa have notched up two major victories against the British, one in the Amatola Mountains where Sandile ambushed Gibson's column, destroying over 60 wagons, then attacking a second wagon train from Grahamstown on its way to Fort Peddie with supplies, which lay just over 60 kilometres east. More than 40 wagons were destroyed in the second attack, and the English cavalry and infantry were forced to shelter inside Fort Peddie with its eight-sided earth walls. Patu of the Qunuqwebe had been particularly successful, but the Amaxhosa were going to commit a cardinal error. They were going to allow hot-headed soldiers to dictate tactics. On the 28th of May, 1846, the largest Amaxhosa army in the Eastern Cape since the failed attempt at taking Grahamstown in 1819 surrounded Fort Peddie. The warriors hadn't needed much convincing because the British were now torching every single Amaxhosa homestead they came across. The fort was a strategic target. It developed from a frontier post established in 1835 and named Fort Peddie after Lieutenant Colonel John Peddie, who led the 72nd Highlanders against the Xhosa in the 6th Frontier War. So 8,000 men from every clan, from the chieftains west of the Kai River, had joined forces, and at midday they were going to launch their attack on this strong defensive position. Fort Peddie had been regarded as a relatively safe outpost surrounded by the resettled Amamfengu people, as well as the Qunuqwebe, who had been allies of the British, but no more. Qunuqwebe chief Patu had switched sides and he was eyeing the Amamfengu for special attention. It was doubly ironic that the British had been forewarned about this coming assault by Ntlambe's own brother, Mgai. He'd been a continuous flow of accurate information, and on the 14th of April told Fort Peddie commander Lieutenant Colonel Martin Lindsay of the 91st Regiment that Peddie was indeed a target. Lindsay was possibly the most disliked British officer in Southern Africa, and some say possibly the most unpopular ever to serve in South Africa. Lindsay's great first mistake was to refuse to help the Amamfengu, although their main settlement was only a few kilometres from his fort. Perhaps he could be forgiven for this lapse of spine because of the size of the Amaxhosa army on its way, but his actions were not honourable. When Patu slammed into the Amamfengu villages, the defenders sent urgent messages for help, but Lindsay did nothing for 2 hours, before relenting and ordering a 200-strong force of the dragoons, infantry and two artillery pieces to go to their aid. The Dragoons were under command of Lieutenant Colonel Robert Richardson of the 7th Dragoon Guards. By the time he arrived at the Amamfengu settlement 5 hours later, their erstwhile allies were still fighting the Amaxhosa. Remarkable, really, a few hundred Amamfengu managing to hold off such a large Amaxhosa army. Richardson fired shells into the Amaxhosa from a distance and then began to advance, fully expecting the enemy to withdraw. However, when the Xhosa warriors turned to face the oncoming British, Richardson's nerves snapped and he ordered the bugles to blow retreat, then hurried back to the fort, leaving his allies, the Amamfengu, to their fate. The Amamfengu, who survived, rushed to join the British, but in a classic us-them style, they were shut out of the fort and made to stand in a ditch that had been dug around the earth-walled fortress while the British soldiers withdrew behind the safety of the walls. The Amamfengu women and children were forced to stand literally with their backs to the fort walls, behind their men who faced the Amaxhosa assault. Above them, the British soldiers watched. It was Richardson's retreat and others like this that had been noted by the Amaxhosa that convinced Sandile that their enemy lacked courage, and also convinced other Xhosa chiefs that the English lacked spine. When considering recent actions, that's hard to dispute. The sun began setting when Mgai and his trusted followers arrived to provide the British with crucial information. They had painted white crosses on their foreheads for quick identification in the dark. As the tension rose in the fort and awaiting the inevitable Amakosa assault, a terrible incident was recorded which further damaged the British soldiers' honour. It was 26th of May, and Lindsay unleashed his rage on a young colonial boy, a wagon driver, who had refused to go out and cut wood in fear of the surrounding Amakosa warriors. In what can only be called a shocking display of bombastic lunacy, Lindsay had this young teen tied to his wagon and then subjected to 25 lashes. This after the child changed his mind and said he would actually go into the bush, preferring to take his chances with the Amakosa than the lash. "Too late," said Lindsay. "It's the lash for you, sonny." When one of the youngster's friends fell to his knees in front of Lindsay, imploring the commander to be lenient, he was also threatened with the lash. What infuriated the colonials about this entire incident is that Lindsay himself had shown himself to be a coward by refusing to help them Mfengu. And here he was, the coward, taking out his venom on a teenager. At least that was the narrative of the time. The teen was summarily lashed. This was an extremely cruel form of British punishment. They lashed their own people. The lash was tipped in lead balls, like the notorious Cat on Nine Tails. Each lash would take place 30 seconds apart, and each would rip at the skin of the back, great spouts of blood welling up. You can imagine a teen being subjected to such a thing, then imagine why the colonials hated Lindsay. Lashing completed, Lindsay's dragoons and the infantry awaited the inevitable. And so it was 2 days later, on the 28th of May, the Pato of the Qunuqwebe and other chiefs led their 8,000 men in the attack on Fort Pedi. The Amakosa faced a withering fire that kept them more than 200 meters away across the open ground, and they took heavy casualties. Almost 100 warriors lay dead by the time the hour-long assault had ended. But the Amakosa had managed to seize 4,000 cattle from the Amamfengu. Lindsay's men had fired their artillery and rockets at the Amakosa warriors, loosing relentless fire on the enemy as they retreated. When the casualty count came in, analysis showed that the Amamfengu had done the real fighting at the fort and caused the most deaths amongst the Amakosa. That didn't stop war reporter Harriet Ward proudly exclaiming that not one white man had died in this battle. At least 12 Amamfengu soldiers had perished. We know why. After the Fort Pedi failure, Sandile decided to focus on the supply lines running through the Eastern Cape, shifting back to his original tactic dreamed up by Makoma. Mhala of Mhlambe and his nephew Siyolo were tasked with this operation. Siyolo hated the British so viscerally, he'd actually offered to head off to help the Boers in Natal during their short fight against the British in 1843. Meanwhile, the British settlers had moved into lagers and the towns fortified the farms where they could, but it was unclear at first if any would survive. They were better prepared than in 1834 when the Sixth Frontier War had seen Amakosa warriors surprising the settlers with their invasion of the Albany district. Now the settlers were fighting for their lives again. It was a terrible situation. 28 years earlier, these immigrants had arrived in an unfamiliar land with the high expectations created by the British government. London, though, had lied about the trouble-free paradise. It was not trouble-free. These settlers had experienced the Sixth Frontier War. They were paranoid. Once more, their rafters were alight, their livestock killed or driven away, and their confidence in settler guns against Amakosa assegais shaken. You see, the Amakosa were now armed with guns and shooting back. John Mitford Barker had commented how the roles had reversed, saying, "It is a new thing for me to be running on foot before blacks mounted on horseback and the balls whistling like hail about me." Mutually inflicted agony was spreading across the Eastern Cape. And if you know anything about war, there are no winners despite the victories. It's a mad impulse, this propensity to violence, the irresistible attraction for the edge of the abyss. The garrison in Grahamstown looked impregnable, but looks are deceiving. For one thing, the dragoons based there had only recently arrived from Ceylon, and many were suffering from illness. Fear and panic filled the streets of this settler town, shots echoing in the hills above, the smoke from the fires on the farms swirling about, visible for miles. The sappers were blockading the streets, and armed burghers galloped into town with fresh news about ruin, murder, and devastation. By the way, the last comment, a little histrionic, came from Harriet Ward, who, as you know, was the wife of Captain John Ward of the 91st Regiment. She also wrote that young girls in Grahamstown were collecting what they considered most valuable, their books, workboxes, trinkets, a guitar, a doll in polka dress. Some carried their pet monkeys and their dogs. Nearby, the officers of the 91st could be seen quietly cleaning their pistols, as merrily as if going pigeon shooting, wrote Harriet. The British fired their artillery into the hills, and at night the bugles would blow. A heavy mist of gunpowder drifted about inside the barracks and the houses. The residents of Grahamstown had a new name for the cannons, Lucifers, for the smell of brimstone hung heavy, the smell of powder and lead. Adding to the smell was the smoke from the first safety matches, which had only just been invented. These were in the hands of the mothers, who scratched at a piece of sandpaper, and the flame flashed in the dark night as they leant over their infants. Imhala of the Ntlambi was approaching, so they had every reason to fear the coming days. 10 days after the Fort Pedi assault, Siyolo and Imhala moved towards the Fish River crossing points separately. There was enough British ammunition at the strong points on both sides to replenish the Amakhosa's gunpowder barrels. But this was not going to be an easy operation. Henry Somerset, yes, the very same man we met so many episodes ago, was leading a force of cavalry nearby. They had been sweeping the countryside and came across the tracks of Imhala's army. Henry Somerset may have been craven, he may have been intellectually challenged, but he was not a coward. He loved a scrap, and here was a chance to get even, he thought. The cavalry caught up to the Amakhosa warriors, and a skirmish developed. Suddenly, almost magically, said one British officer later, the Amakhosa disappeared.
They disperse, said the officer, in a manner which no other troops in the world possess. They disappear like needles in straw.
Unfortunately for the needles in straw, British horses appeared smarter than their riders. One of the horses then bolted towards a nearby ridge, and the rider looked down into a small river, and there were the soldiers of Siyolo, Imhala's nephew, caught in the open along the Gwangqa River. The 7th Dragoon officers called their men, ordering the bugler to blow for a fast trot. However, the nervous youngster belted out the bugle call for gallop. Then, even more panicked, he bugled charge. Perhaps it was this mad, mistaken bugle call, but the cavalry machine that he had set in motion developed a force of its own. The Amakhosa responded by firing their muskets at the charging dragoons. It must have been a terrifying sight. Hundreds of men on horseback with flashing swords descending at high speed from the ridge towards the unnerved Amakhosa. The Amakhosa had never put much store in shooting practice. Their aim was never very good. Most shots missed the dragoons, musket balls whistling overhead. Like a flight of birds, one said. The Amakhosa commanders had been caught in two minds. Had Siyolo deployed his centre and wings, pulled the assegai carrying men into line, things may have been different, say military historians. Instead, they continued trying to load the muskets, then dropped their guns to pick up their assegais. Too late, the dragoons were upon them. And, hearing the gunshots at a distance, a detachment of Boer and Khoi Khoi nearby galloped into the fray as well, and their marksmanship was of the highest order. The combination of the flashing, deadly blades of the dragoons and the sharp shooting of the Khoisan and the Boers broke the Amakhosa warriors, and they fled across the plain, harried by cavalry who cut them down one after the other. For the first time in their history of struggle, the Khoza had committed the cardinal error of trying to slug it out with British regular soldiers on open ground, and the result was a terrible bloodletting. The dragoons mauled this Khoza army, killing 500 warriors in a couple of hours. Their bodies littered the veldt. Their bones could be seen months later. Sir Peregrine Maitland called this a brilliant event, while Colonel John Mitford Barker was more pragmatic. He called the victory at the Gwangqa River a freak of fortune. Needless to say, Barker and his ilk had no time at all for the British soldiers, particularly their officers, and the feeling was mutual. Only in America, in similar circumstances, had there been such fervent mutual contempt. As you'll hear, by the time the Seventh Frontier War was over, the British colonials hated the British army almost as much as they did the Xhosa. Maitland had another problem. Most of the Boers had trekked away, and the British had always relied on the Boers as well as the Khoisan when it came to war against the African people living in the Eastern Cape. The Boers who remained refused to serve under Maitland or Somerset or Lindsay or any other English officer. In what can only be called an ironic flip, they now demanded that André Stockenstroom return to take command of the Burghers. Stockenstroom, whom the colonials had demonized, the man who'd banned the notorious commando system, even the editor of the Grahamstown Journal, Robert Godlinton, changed his tune about Stockenstroom. Previously, they'd condemned his system in the ceded territory. Now they wanted him back. The Amakosa had decided they'd done enough damage and withdrew into the highlands of the Amatola Mountains and the fastnesses of the Fish River Bush. Still, there was no safety anywhere between the mountains and the Indian Ocean, between the Great Escarpment and the sea. Bands of warriors roamed about, looking for soft targets. Orders for all ammunition baggage trains were changed. The British columns had to travel with a slow candle so that their ammunition wagons could be blown up when attacked to stop the gunpowder and lead from falling into Amakosa hands. Fort Peddy was still being threatened. Maitland had been compelled to establish a special beach landing area at the mouth of the Fish River just to get supplies to this beleaguered garrison because the road from Grahamstown was so dangerous. As the war and the year went on, South Africa's weather patterns interceded. In the early days of April, the scattered rainfall had created problems for British wagons, but now the patchy rain had dissipated. It was officially a drought, and a severe drought of 1846 and 47. Soon the oxen were haggard and the horses were bone thin. The British were going to pay for starting a war without ensuring access to food for man and beast, and the Amakosa took advantage of this critical shortage of fodder. They burned the grass wherever the British moved, exacerbating an already difficult situation. John Hare, the Eastern Cape commander, and Sir Peregrine Maitland had launched their war against the Amakosa, believing they could overcome their enemy quickly. Instead, the war dragged on. Maitland began receiving complaints from the colonials, official complaints that the war was being run by men who were incompetent and disorganized. And that was Hare, the Eastern Cape Lieutenant Governor. Bowker sent a letter pointing out that Colonel Hare and Colonel Lindsay are looked upon with suspicion, distrust, and disgust. He continued, Colonel Hare has, through want of judgment and foresight, brought ruin upon this frontier, whose every act up to this moment is that of incompetence and imbecility. I denounce Colonel Hare as totally unfit to hold any command in Her Majesty's service, and I demand that he be placed under immediate arrest. Just in case Maitland was confused, Bowker added, Colonel Lindsay has also forfeited the confidence of the colonists by his equivocal conduct whilst in command of Fort Peddy and his tyrannous bearing in petty matters. Bowker was obviously referring to Lindsay lashing the poor young teenage colonial. These criticisms, by the way, were aimed at officers who'd fought Napoleon at Waterloo. However, African warfare is a totally different kettle of snook, of course. They may have been on the same side, but the dragoons and the other sections of the British army were horrified at the camp of carelessly clad and dust-disfigured burghers. Here was Maitland, turned out in epaulettes and his step-outs, grand old man of Waterloo, standing alongside men in crumpled brown and corduroy, dirty, no uniform unless their floppy hats could be called that, and yet it was clear to a neutral observer that the men in the stained duffel clothing and crushed hats were the superior soldiers. The defeat of the Nhlambe at Gwangqa River meant that the tide was turning against the Amakosa, and yet the colonials and the British were being run ragged. The British army was reliant on a dishevelled group of Boers, Khoisan, and colonials. They were taking advice from Stockenstroom, another colonial. This war the British had started 4 months ago was floundering, and all their expertise and empire seemed to account for little on the slopes of the Amatola Mountains. Determined to crush Sandile, by June 1846, Maitland had managed to cobble together the largest army ever seen in southern Africa, 14,000 men strong, including 3,000 British Army regulars. It took another month for this monster to rise, and its shuddering actions through the next 6 months
were going to be fitful. Just to give you an idea about the scale of this army, the entire British army around the world numbered 132,000 in 1846, close to 1% of the male population of the UK. So Maitland's monster was considerable. This army was going to march across the Kai River to Gqeberha country, beyond Sandile's land to Swahili's land, that Gqeberha and Transkei had avoided joining this war, but the British didn't care. What happened next is for episode 167. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform. It helps elevate the visibility, and you can head off to desmondlatham.blog, where I'll load an update about this episode. You can also email me from there. Until next, goodbye. Thank you.